Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
And there's my Dave Solomon doing what he does so well. Oh, and does he do so much so well. So proud of the relationship that I have with Dave. Haven't seen him for a while, but he's doing his thing in Philly. And at these days, let me tell you something. I'm just glad when friends are alive and well and doing their thing. I just got news of a gentleman that I worked with in Nashville for a brief and shining time at Lightning 100, David Hall. And he just passed away the other day, suddenly, as far as I know. God rest his soul, and condolences and big hugs to all his family and friends in Nashville. I'm going to get to see you folks one of these days, I promise you. Miss my old stomping grounds. God bless you all for being here. This is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. And man, we got some music for you today. Love it when it comes together like this and you get some old chestnuts and the new stuff and then a little surprise here and there and you bring it all together and it makes this interesting hybrid stew, doesn't it? Ron Kearns is going to be here. Now, you heard him a few weeks ago. He did not get his allotted hour, so I'm going to make sure he does today. We got some good things to make sure you start off your show right. And with that, I'm going to give you Cannonball Adderley. We have to go back to the song from time to time. Mercy, mercy, mercy.
You know, sometimes we're not prepared for adversity. When it happens, sometimes we're caught short. We don't know exactly how to handle it when it comes up. Sometimes we don't know just what to do when adversity takes over. And I have advice for all of us. I got it from my pianist, Joe Zawinul, who wrote this tune. And it sounds like what you're supposed to say when you have that kind of problem. It's called mercy, mercy, mercy.
Thank you.
Mercy, 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 mercy. Thank you.
loves you, it's no good unless they love you all the way. Happy to be near you when you need someone to cheer you all the way. Taller than the tallest tree, that's how it's gotta be. Deeper than a deep blue sea, that's how deep it goes. If it's real, when somebody needs you, it's no good unless they need you. All the way through the good old lean years and for all those in between years, come what may. Who knows where the road will lead us? Only a fool would say. If you let me love you, it's for sure I'm gonna love you all the way, all the way.
Thank you.
Oh, don't you just love it when a more than capable vocalist knows their way around a treasured song? Dina DeRose, the name of that lady, all the way from her CD Walk in the Park from 2005. Very interesting lady, this Dina DeRose. Born in Binghamton? Talk much, Trish? New York. And just loved jazz so much. Dad was a construction worker, and Mom was an ice capades dancer. Yep. And in her teen years, Dina got into her car and drove to New York City so she could see Hank Jones and Mulgrew Miller play. She was a pianist, and at the age of 21, she was diagnosed with carpal tunnel syndrome and arthritis. And it put a lid on her piano playing for a good long time. She got into a depression. She got into some drinking and some drugs. She got over all of that. She had a procedure done. In the meantime, she discovered that she had a great voice and used to hang out in the clubs honing this craft. And then she got her piano skills back, and she put them all together. She has done so well for herself. She has had a few CDs out, and now she's a teacher in Australia. Moreover, she got a Fulbright to Turkey. That's where she is now, and she also goes to Spain and to Holland for summer camps and for workshops. She's really got a sweet life, and what a sweet rendition of that song, Dina DeRose. Kevin, Tony had to play that track. Couldn't play it the other day because it just didn't fit into the scheme of things, especially after Kevin got finished talking to us for over an hour. Oh, my, that was wonderful. But back again in 2005, you probably know that Def Jazz came on the scene as an answer to Def Jam artists, and that was Gerald Albright and Kevin Tony on the keyboard, and that was Hey Young World. If you remember, Slick Rick in 1988 had the song out first. Gosh, I'm a little bit hesitant to ask about Slick Rick these days, but I'll just bypass that. Also on the CD, Hubert Laws, Rick Braun, Roy Hargrove, among others. Really a very cool CD. And, of course, all the more reason why it's cool, because Kevin Tony had so much input in it. To start the set, Cannonball Adderley, Mercy, 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 from that particular title, Live at the Club in 1966. And, of course, it was not live at the club at all. But it sounded sure sweet. It was in the Capitol Recording Studios, a very select and very, how shall we say, slightly inebriated crowd, voicing their pleasure at everything. And, of course, Cannonball Adderley, king of the alto sax on that. God, I love him so much. Brother Nat on cornet. Joe Zawinul, the writer of the song, on keys, bless his heart. Victor Gaskin on bass and Roy McCurdy on drums. Julian Edwin Cannonball Adderley. Ron Kearns coming your way. Coming up at the 3 o'clock hour, we've got a couple of hours worth of music, which will be great, and it'll zip by, I'm telling you. We have a few guests that we're going to announce, and one of them I just talked to yesterday, Tracy Hamlin, who has been touring with Gloria Gaynor, by the way. Just had her picture taken with folks who dropped by a Gloria Gaynor session, Chaka Khan and Grace Jones. That picture with Sister Sledge, by the way, is on my Facebook page in case you're interested. But Tracy Hamlin's going to join us on the 21st. Two members of Afro Blue coming up. And I have to tell you that Mark Mosley is coming your way 2 days after Valentine's Day on the 16th. Baltimore Bread, Mark Mosley. This is from TLC, and it's Misty on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
As a kid. like I'm clinging to a cloud. I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Walk my way and a thousand violins begin to play. Or it might be the sound of your hello. That music I hear, I get misty the moment you're near. You can say that you're
in love.
I could listen to that for the rest of the afternoon. Whoo! The incredible, underrated, honestly, Grant Green on guitar. An amazing individual. Born in June of 1935, passed away too soon at the age of 43 in 1979. Did mostly all his work on Blue Note Records. That was Round About Midnight, the Monk Song from Green Street, recorded in April of 1961. And it's interesting because a lot of folks will say that Grant Green really influenced them a whole lot. His guitar playing is distinctive, and a major reason why is because apart from Charlie Christian, this gentleman had influences that ranged from mostly saxophonist to Miles Davis on trumpet. So he picked up on a vibe, on a technique that sax players had, and he transferred that into guitar. And my gosh, when you hear him play, and any work that you can think of that he did, and as a matter of fact, from 61 to 65 on Blue Note Records, he had more appearances on that label, both as a session guy and as a band leader, than anybody on that very prestigious record label. Just an amazing body of work, very significant for somebody who passed away when he was only 43. Guitarist and composer and great guy. Of course, he was one of those guys that got into the horrors that sometimes people get involved in, and especially during that time. The temptations were out there, certainly for Grant Green. The drugs were there, and he had a heart attack. That's how he left us. So the doctors had warned him not to play out, and he really wanted to play again because he was not doing well for a spell, and he wanted to play, but you know what? You got to go out while you're doing the things that you love to do. A lot of people say that, and I agree. Because what is the meaning of life? My poor father, I'll never forget this. My father was working for Philadelphia Electric for a long time, over 40 years. And he had a few heart attacks. And the doctors at that time had said to him, Gene, you can't do anything. So he couldn't even do gardening, which he loved to do. And the lack of activity is the thing that kills you. So honestly, what would you rather do if you have something in your life that you love, like me, one of these days, hopefully a long time from now, but it would be nice to be able to still do some sort of radio and to just peacefully just go, you know? Who's to say? None of us know how we are going to go, and we've been talking about that a lot in varying circles because a lot of people who are of varying ages, and I'm not just talking about older people, but younger people as well, are just going. Their time is up, and they go. So be ready when he comes, okay? That's all I'm saying. GuitaristMarkMosley.com is where you need to go to find out more on Baltimore-based Mark Mosley, who we heard before Grant Green, from his CD TLC, that was Misty, with Ray Anthony on vocals. That was nice. Mark is going to be at the Mid-Atlantic Jazz Festival, don't you know, on February 17th, and he'll be talking about that on the 16th when he joins the show, probably for about 45 minutes or so. He's got a pretty heavy-duty schedule because he is a teacher during the day. So we'll talk to Mark Mosley. Let's turn our attention to somebody else who was on the show very recently, Roy Cross, a multimedia artist. And my golly, if you have seen his artwork and then hear him play steel drum, you know we're talking about some talent. This is a tune called Double J, and we'll tell you where Roy is going to be, as a matter of fact, tomorrow night. Steel drum with some excellent backing folks here. This is Roy Cross on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Thank you. That's just crazy, isn't it? Woo! Just in time for Valentine's Day. One of the all-time best songs ever. Someone to Watch Over Me in the Capable Hands of Chris Botti on trumpet. Man alive. I know that there are some folks, and you know what? It's with everything these days. Some people love some folks that are in the limelight. Some people do not ever want to hear them again or see them. But Chris Botti, you really have to experience him in person before you make any judgment call on him, because I know the straight-ahead people don't necessarily consider him one of the fold. But I assure you that when he was in Baltimore some years ago, actually just maybe about 5 or so years ago, with David Sanborn, they did a tribute to Miles Davis. And I just don't care. I will hold this discussion with anybody. Chris Botti has the right to do anything he wants. He is just amazing, and he works, check this out, 250-plus days a year. This man is homeless. He really doesn't have a place to call his own. He calls hotel rooms home. He's really, when you get down to the nitty-grit and know the kind of circumstances in which he grew and showing promise very early on, as a matter of fact, to the point where he had 2 grants from the National Endowment for the Arts at a very young age, and he got to study under Woody Shaw. That's some sweet stuff right there. Born in Portland, Oregon, raised in Corvallis, spent 2 years in Italy because that's part of his lineage. Botti is an Italian name, and I'm glad to see that he's going to be in Washington, D.C. on the 17th, and then he's going to be in Atlantic City on the 18th. That from his 2004 When I Fall in Love CD, that was the one where people said, oh, this child has got some real interesting chops. Someone to Watch Over Me with, by the way, Brian Bromberg on bass, Billy Childs on keyboard. Oh, my, so nice. Paulino Da Costa on percussion. And, man, he's cooking. Full steam ahead for Chris Botti. Touring dates. He's booked until well into next year. I'm not kidding. Just amazing. We also heard, what else did we hear? Oh, yes, Gretchen Parlato. Phew. Mercy me. Got a chance to interview her on Cool Jazz Conversations, which, by the way, is taking a hiatus. I think you know that by now. Gretchen, part of the Mosaic Project from Terry Lynn Carrington. That is up for the 54th Grammy Awards Best Jazz Vocal Album nomination. Very excited about that. And let us go through the list of the all-female ensemble on this, shall we? Just breathtaking. Terry Lynn Carrington, of course, on drums. Diane Reeves, Dee Dee Bridgewater, Carmen Lundy, Linda Taylor, Nona Hendricks, Cassandra Wilson, Esperanza Spalding, Helen Sung, Taniki Postma, Jerry Allen, Ingrid Jensen, Sheila E., Patrice Rushen, a little guest spot from Angela Davis. All of those fabulous females on one project. It is sheer majesty. You must get the Mosaic Project. We heard, too, Roy Cross and Double J, written by his friend and former bandmate Larry Matz, or Maltz, I should say. Roy Cross is going to be with his new band at Andy Musique tomorrow night in Baltimore. If you are local, please join me and root this man on. Such a busy guy. We were trying in the chat room to figure out where to send folks to see his art. Now, I think that we can send you to roycross/neoimages.net. He doesn't have a regular website from what I can determine, but you will see his artwork, and that includes painting and sculpture and varying other creative endeavors. And the music, you're just going to have to buy it from him in person. We've got to figure out a way where he can get a website where it's all-encompassing, like my buddy Randy Everett, who is also a painter and a musician, and it's all on one website. We'll get to more of Randy later, like in the next few weeks because he's going to be on the show too. It's very exciting. All right, let's get to more music, shall we? Let's do it. Shelly Mann, you might not know the name, but let me tell you what, you probably know his work through the years. God bless him, no longer with us, passed away in 1984. Just a prolific drummer, a creative guy that astounded some people. And some of those people have been legends in the business. Just the way he played was really special. He did an album, actually over a three-day period at a club in San Francisco, the Blackhawk. There's volume 1 through 5, I believe, and this is from volume 4. Shelly Mann on drums, and actually it's Shelly Mann and his men at the Blackhawk, and this is a song called Nightingale on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy and Roy, or should I say, listen to me, Ron Kearns is coming your way at the top of next hour. Actually, pretty close to the top of next hour. He's going to come in a little early. So you'll be enjoying him and enjoy Shelly Mann right now. Rosanna Vitro is all about when she lands there. Grammys, this coming Sunday, let me tell you what, this child is ready. She's got a stretch limo with a bunch of relatives in there. Can you imagine making the trek from like New Jersey to L.A. in this chauffeur-driven limousine with relatives and friends? Oh my gosh, you talk about a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Rosanna Vitro up for a Grammy, the same Grammy that Terry Lynn Carrington wants to win for Best Vocal Performance. That's Rosanna's take on the Randy Newman song, Mama Told Me Not to Come, from the music of Randy Newman. Yes, we know that Three Dog Night did it so well back in the day, but a lot of folks don't necessarily know who writes these songs, and they just assume that the group or the act that's singing the song has written it as well. But Not the case. Very interesting and just so satisfying take of that song. Randy Newman is blown away, and I'm just hoping that he shows up for the Grammys on Sunday so he can cheer his friend on. That is so cool. Rosanna Vitro, really a wonderful gal. Can't wait to be able to bring her onto Hybrid Jazz. She has been on Cool Jazz Conversations, but not this show. So whoever wins this Grammy and whoever doesn't win this Grammy, we're just going to bring them on. That's all there is to it. Dizzy Gillespie, we heard from 1985, the song Every Morning from New Faces. Dizzy just decided to change things up a little bit, and the reaction was just so amazing because he had been in the business for so long, of course, and when he brought these new cats into the scene, like Robbie Amin and Kenny Kirkland and Branford Marsalis, they just popped that album so much. Lonnie Plaxico, also a part of that, ex-Blakey member, and just real nice to see this group get together, and that Dizzy, because he had done this a number of times in his career, making sure that these young cats and young women get mentored the right way. I've heard so many great stories about how he has taken people aside and made sure they know that if there's anything he can answer for them, honestly, he would rather be there knowing that he got the truth out to them than them to fall into the wrong clutches. He saved many a person in their career from getting involved with the wrong folks or the wrong management, just so you know. Dizzy Gillespie, New Faces from the 80s. I love that. Also, Shelly Mann. Golly, this was recorded over a three-day period in San Francisco. Shelly Mann on drums. Such a cool guy. New York City born, but he was associated a lot with the West Coast jazz movement. He could do any style you could possibly want, any kind of bop. He could do Dixieland. He could do rag. He could do, and he did, film and TV music so unbelievably and made sure that he got entrenched with the right folks. Coleman Hawkins made use of Shelly Mann on drums, Dizzy himself, Charlie Parker, Woody Herman, Stan Kenton. One of the cool things about Shelly is this, and this is from, 1959, what you heard. Shelly Mann and his men at the Blackhawk, Volume 4 for Nightingale, the song that you heard. One of those sweet little asides that I love so much. Shelly met a New York rockette in 1943. She was beautiful, and her name was Flip. And that marriage lasted until the day that Shelly Mann passed away in 1984. Isn't that cool? I just love to hear stories like that. Joe Gordon was helping out Richie Kamuka, Victor Feldman, and Monty Budwig on that particular set of CDs. I want to get all of them. I just enjoyed that so much, a 12-minute track. Yay! Well, we had a request, actually, from yesterday. And I thought I'd let Norman Woods know that I'm about to play it. Our special guest, coming up, as a matter of fact, in the next 20 minutes or so, a little bit early, is Ron Kearns. Ron has a brand new CD out. Actually, I've got it. It's not exactly out yet. He's going to tell you about it. It's called Quiet Nights. It is just so beautiful, I can't even say. We're going to hear from three tracks from that CD. But Norman wanted to hear Nookie's Blues from Ron Kearns and Friends. So we're going to play it for you right now on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Love is falling into a black hole. To witness feeling sinking fast, watching, while at the same time question the succession of the repressed. Prisoner by choice, or just a victim of naivety? Love is not a scholarly thing, even though some try to make it academic. Will I ever get it? And if I do, will my lack of experience or piecemeal definitions reinforce a retrogressive sense of self-loathing? No need to check my notes, not me. I'm always falling short. And this will fuel the reasoning that makes it easier for insights and acute decisions to magically come to me, powered by ego, and make it easy to let go. Tell yourself, light the fuse of hurt, so that I will not be burdened with regret. Sing victory songs to those who say what they would never compromise. Well, I hope you know that from failure given before any test, from Neanderthal effort still secure at its best, a song will be sung breaking the secret code of an ancient language spoken by the unloved. Look upon my face. After falling across the line in the sand of what most will not tolerate, one that has been drawn and moved countless times, I have ignored all the warnings to all who were dared not to cross. Only so that you might understand that if an opportunity to love falls from the sky, some voices of emotional liberalism will slowly grow faint, then evaporate. And you might find yourself alone, standing at the edge of the black hole, trying to decide if you should wipe with or toss in a towel, one that has been saturated with evidence of emotional truth. Believe me when I say, we've all been there. Or you will be pulled in by a succession of repression, never knowing if it was your chance you were throwing away.
Come on with me, 'cause I'm going with a funny. Don't get lazy now. Just a little bit up the road. Just around this. There's something going round inside my head. I think it's something I see.
Song. Just had to play The main ingredient, happiness is just around the bend. 1974, Euphrates River, everybody. Come on now. Man alive, that is such good stuff. You just have to lean back and savor that, don't you? Those of us who remember really well. Now, some stuff we don't necessarily want to remember, but we do remember. Just to give you a little bit of background, Made Ingredient was formed originally in 1964 in Harlem, New York, called The Poets. And it consisted of the lead singer at that time, Donald McPherson, Luther Simmons Jr., and Tony Sylvester, who was born in Panama. And they had their first recordings for Lieber and Stoller's Red Bird label. And there was, you know, as any group goes through these changes, they went through changes. They teamed up with a record producer, Bert DiCotto, and under his direction, they got into the top 30 on the R&B charts. 1970, You've Been My Inspiration. Then another song broke the top 20, cover of the Impressions, I'm So Proud. Well, something happened. Donald McPherson contracted leukemia, and then he suddenly passed away. 1971, Cuba Gooding Sr. came into the picture. He was a backing vocalist on some of their recordings, and then suddenly, here he is. And then Everybody Plays the Fool. Yep, which was at least number 2 on the R&B charts and also number 3 on the pop charts and just kept rolling along. And then, you know, I don't know what exactly is happening these days, and maybe it's just as well, but I don't know. But I'll tell you what, things are looking real good for Cuba Gooding Jr., aren't they? I'm just going to say that because I'll have to mention Red Tails again as one of the all-time great films, and Cuba Gooding Jr. is in that. So both father and son have really done well with their careers. And just a little blurb. I know it's hybrid jazz, and I'm really kind of stretching it if I do. Happiness is just around the bend because I really do want to focus on those who really do have the priority of being known as jazz artists. But I had to play it especially after Inside. Norman Woods, you heard Succession and Repression from Still Loving the Art of It. Now, you know that Norman was with us about a month or so ago, and it was just one of the best times ever on the show because this man is one of the more fascinating individuals you will ever meet in your life. California-based, and Lord, has he been through some changes himself. And now things are just so amazing for him because he appreciates all of those challenges. And anything you ever wanted to learn about him, you can learn from going here. www.journeyfromtheinside, and that's just N as in Nancy, inside. Just an N and then SIDE.com, because you will see the movie. The movie tells everything. And then you can see the varying works and you can buy everything. A jazz poet, yes, indeed. And he really takes this very seriously. And that is one of my favorite pieces by him, Succession in Repression. I love him. He's in the chat room. He frequently is. We love this. And hello to Linda and Debbie and to Griselda and to our guests who wish to remain nameless. We also heard from Ron Kearns, by the way, Nookie's Blues. And that was a request from Norman because he just loves that jam from Ron Kearns and Friends. And you know what? Before Ron joins us, he's going to join us a little bit early, I wanted to play something for you from one of the bandmates that's in Ron's new CD, Quiet Nights. Mark Prince, there's another drummer. I can't say enough about how outstanding Mark Prince is and about how this work, Fraction of Infinity, is one of those hybrid jazz, I don't even know what to call it. It's got classical, it's got elements of world, it's got contemporary jazz, it's certainly got straight ahead. It's got this spiritual vibe to it, and I'm just going to let you decide for yourself. I just think this song is so appropriate to play right now. It's called Gratitude from Ma, from Fraction of Infinity. Mark Prince on Hybrid Jazz. from Trish Hennessy. You'll love this.
Thank you.
just had to play that particular track because I really love Mark Prince so much as a human being, certainly as an artist, and I can't say enough about that CD. And why I'm playing him right now is because I want you to know the kind of people that Ron Kearns puts around him. Ron Kearns doesn't have a great reputation for nothing. He makes sure that the people that are around him really get what the music is supposed to be all about. And actually, I just explained to my friend Griselda here in the chat room that it's upscale instrumental music, what you will hear from Fraction of Infinity. That particular track is called Gratitude for Ma. Speaking of Ron Kearns, he is there on time. I wanted to get him in a little early because he did not have his due last time, and we had to shoo him away unnecessarily. Here he is again. Let me tell you what this man is all about. He is not only a premier saxophonist who is the proud daddy of a brand new CD, but he is also a teacher, a mentor, an author, a producer, a composer. What the heck else am I missing, Ron?
I'm a father.
Oh, okay.
That's a big claim to fame.
Well, okay, I was thinking professionally, but yes, I did say
well,
you are a new daddy of the CD.
Yeah, well, I was talking about my daughter, but yes, with the CD, of course. You know, it's interesting you were playing Mark because that CD has such a good vibe to it, and that particular song shows how important the history of the music is because Mark channeled a little bit of the Poinciana from Ahmed Jamal and other things in that, and it also gives you a little flavor of a tune that's a beautiful tune that a lot of people aren't too familiar with called A Ruby in the Pearl, and Pearl. And
interesting.
As you said, that extra bit of sophistication that you hear is very important.
Well, there's no question. I mean, it's really interesting that you have this unique friendship with Mark because, you know, friendship can come in all ages and all colors and all religions. And you and I are about the same age, and Mark is, I don't know, how old is Mark?
I don't know, but Mark was one of my former students from years ago. So he's at least 20 years younger than I am. So I'm not sure his age.
And it seems like such a natural union for you and Mark to be able to work together because he is such an old soul. He really is.
Yeah.
And he grasps music in a way that is light years ahead of him. It's as though he's like 70 or 80 years old. And you feel that on the CD because he wanted to convey that. He wanted to convey different kinds of spiritual elements as well on that CD.
Right. Well, you know, Mark is one of those people that you can always tell is a student of the history of the music. And because of that, he knows how to pay homage to the masters and to try to keep the tradition going. And I like being around people who do that because it's our turn to carry the torch, and then it's our responsibility to pass the torch along. And so Mark is one of those guys who is going to carry and then pass because his willingness to study the history and to be a part of the history as well as being an innovator, creating something new that will eventually be historical is very important. It says a lot about the kind of person he is.
And you know what? It occurred to me today, Ron, because I hadn't thought about it. There's just far too much on my mind. But I was looking forward to talking to you again, and then I realized that it's February 9th that we're doing this show, and I thought, okay, wow, it's Black History Month. And no one is more important to have on a show in February in speaking about this than you. You always make sure that people know facts and historical evidence and things that others may never have learned in school. I know that we did not learn so much about inventors, about people who were involved in music and social activism long before the 60s rolled along. What would you – I mean, we're going to talk about Quiet Nights for sure, but you saw my post yesterday about going to the post office, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so insane to me that here we are at 2012, and I have to ask for stamps with black and brown faces on them. I mean, apart from Black History Month, these are stamps. These are postage stamps. It should be a no-brainer about these kinds of things involved in the United States of America. I mean, I get on a high horse about some things, and people try to calm me down, but should I be on a high horse about this?
Well, the one thing that you should be on a high horse about is the fact that it's all American history.
Exactly.
Know, and the only reason we have to celebrate Black History Month is that for so many years, the achievements of African Americans and Black people had been left out of the history books, that it was important to have a particular time that focused the attention on it, hopefully through that one month, to encourage them to use the 11 remaining months to really delve into what's going on and just what kinds of things we all as Americans did to build this great country. And
right.
The reality is, at this time, there are a lot of kids who fortunately, in some ways, don't think in terms of black, white, or any other ethnicity. They think of people because their friends are just people to them, and they don't make the distinction. And I'm glad that I lived to the point that I was able to see this. But I'm also sorry that because of that relaxed feeling, there's not that sense of urgency to make sure that everybody knows about everybody else's culture. I used to make a big difference between desegregation and integration, because desegregation was when everybody was able to go to the same places and do the same kinds of things. But integration was where all cultures were mixed in and put together, so that you realize that when people say that the United States is a melting pot, it is supposed to be a melting pot where everybody brings in their own little flavor and puts that flavor in, and everybody acknowledges that this flavor is good, but the whole recipe is very important.
Yes.
And so as a teacher, I tried to always make sure that everybody knew that, yes, different ethnic groups do different things, but there's a common cause. And you were talking about Red Tails earlier, and Red Tails was an example of that, because the Tuskegee Airmen felt that they were fighting for the United States of America. They didn't look at themselves necessarily as doing anything for their race, but they were very much aware that their race was an important factor in what they were doing, and that they had a responsibility to represent their forefathers in a positive way. And so as we look in terms of Black History Month, or celebrating different kinds of months, we also want to make sure that we don't do them as separate things, but as part of the whole. And I think that sometimes is what's missing. And then the fact that we take for granted that we have already come to that point where we don't need to make sure that young black boys and girls know their history and know the achievements of their forefathers. And music is one of those areas where the culture is definitely mixed. And when you listen to a recording, you don't know the race or the ethnicity of anybody on the recording unless someone tells you that. You listen to the music and you hear the music, and that's all that's important to you, the fact that you are hearing good music.
Yeah. It's a complicated scenario for me to talk about it, because, you know, growing up in Philadelphia, and because my parents were lenient in letting me see so much of what was on TV and in films, I got hit early on. For whatever reason, it affected me so deeply. I was very young, and as were you, and I saw what was happening on TV in the 60s, when there was so much bloodshed, so much death, fighting for civil rights. So I get very sensitized very quickly about things that are a no-brainer. I want all of this to be a no-brainer, and I know exactly what you're saying about Black History Month. You would hope that this month that's designated as such would enhance the notion and the passion to make others feel compelled to make sure that they know all that they can know and embrace as much as they are willing to embrace. And that's a tough road for some folks in this country about history that is not exactly reflective of your lineage. It's reflective of somebody else's lineage. We have to know as much as we can about the cultures in this country and never, ever, and man, Ron, is it coming to the surface now with this political climate that we're in? Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, you know, it's coming to the surface now, but I grew up in Southwest Virginia, in a city called Roanoke, Virginia, and we had a lot of people who were very much aware of what needed to be done to excel, irrespective of what your background was. And so it was always put to the forefront with us that excellence and achievement will balance out with anything. And just because you're behind in the race doesn't mean that you don't continue to run. And in fact, we were always told if you're behind in a race, you have to run harder. And so those kinds of things really get ingrained in you when people are pushing you and saying those kinds of things. And it's not teaching you to dislike anybody or anything. It's just to make you aware that this is the way things are, and that sometimes the best way to fight hatred and discrimination is through excellence and focus on what you can do rather than what someone prohibits you from doing.
Well, that's really a good point. And you have done, I mean, you and I have this relationship where I can't necessarily say this because I smile. We communicate a lot back and forth. But honestly, your reputation is so amazing, and it's not just because you're an amazing saxophonist who knows that instrument inside and out. The reputation of you as a teacher, as a mentor, as a friend, as a person. I was talking about Dizzy Gillespie earlier and the fact that he mentored so many people and made sure that they knew the truth about what they were getting themselves into. You have that paternal aspect about you in that you will make sure that folks know all of these students that you have and you've had, that this is a business that has many twists and turns. That reputation that you have is just fabulous. That, biblically speaking, that is the mark of an honorable man. So
thank you.
You know what you're talking about.
I'll never forget the first time that I met Diz. I discovered the importance of having two ears and one mouth, because I kept the one mouth closed and kept the two ears open. And the first opportunity I had to go to a festival and have my students meet and be involved with Dizzy, I jumped at the chance and took a group of kids who really weren't that well-versed in jazz at the time and didn't understand anything about the traditions and history of jazz. But when they got a chance to be around Dizzy and hear the kinds of stories he said and the kinds of things that he did, it let them know that we are in a continuum, that everybody has to keep the word out there. And one of the African traditions that was so important that I learned years ago was that it's important to pass things on verbally so that people hear it and each person tells someone else, and the old tradition of each one reach one. Because for a long time, we couldn't go to books. You know, when I was growing up, I couldn't go to books and find out African-American history or anything. I mean, there were some, you know, you knew about George Washington Carver, you knew about Booker T. Washington, but you didn't know about the Morgans that did the stoplights and refrigeration. You didn't know about the Otis that came up with the elevator and different things. And you didn't also know that because of one of the things that George Washington Carver did, the development of vinyl came about. And when you think about the fact that the record industry was all vinyl for many, many years.
Oh yeah.
You could actually attribute the success of the record industry to George Washington Carver.
I love it.
Who invented vinyl, and little things like that, little details like that, that you don't necessarily see unless you really seek out or unless someone is able to tell you what's going on. It's just important that those of us who can articulate it and those of us who can make sure that others can hear it, say it, because it's all part of the continuum.
When you were little, did you get involved in history early on? Did you have a hunger for it, or was your hunger for music? And did you use music to escape from the world? I don't know why I want to ask you that question, but I do.
Yeah. Well, my father was a minister, and he was a civil rights activist. And
yeah.
So I was very much aware of civil rights and those different things. And, of course, being a child of the church, you cannot be a child of the church without having some involvement with music or being
involved with
music. And so for me, it was all entwined. It was life. My involvement in the different activities that I was involved in led to music. And I used to always tell people that one of the things, whenever I had problems, I would always go grab my horn. That was the first thing I would do. That was my opiate, grabbing my horn and playing it and literally as Horace Silver said, blowing away the blues. And it's very important that young people know that they have those kinds of ways of being able to vent rather than necessarily getting into some of the negative behaviors and things that people try to do to escape and to self medicate. And so my father was a big time historian, and so he passed things on, across the dining room table, and when you hear the stories and when you hear the history, it makes you want to investigate a little bit more, and so I guess from that, the fire was lit inside me.
Wow, that's and you used the term self medicate. Man, how many times have we had discussions on here about the importance of passing along the knowledge of instrumentation to children? To give them an instrument and for them to gravitate to a particular instrument, time after time, and gosh, I've been doing these interviews since 1976, all told. So you hear about somebody that picked up an instrument, and from that moment forward, that became medicine, that became healing, that became your best friend. And think of what we're denying kids now when we are pulling back these programs in school. It breaks my heart. I know that breaks yours.
Yeah, well, when the founding fathers established schools, Horace Mann and all the main educators, acknowledged the need to develop the whole person. And music was an integral part of that. And,
yeah.
And so some of the earliest things that they did for music education were songbooks. And it was to prepare congregations to be able to sing. And so they developed the technique that helped people in congregations learn how to sing. And so singing in America developed through the churches. And then so when the education system came along, they simply took the best things that they had gotten from the churches and things and made sure that they were taught in the schools. And once again, the whole concept and the whole idea was to develop the whole man. And I mean that in the man, male and female way of using man.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, it just stands to reason. If you are learning music, it's not just, in quotes, an artistic endeavor. You are also paving the way for someone to have learned how to use math and to understand it more clearly. So when folks say, and this is why we have to work so hard to make sure that people get voted into office that are supposed to be there, the people who get that notion that music is part of a whole person, and that it paves the way for them to be a better person for the rest of their lives. Those are the people that we want to make the decisions about our children, because looking at the choices that we have out here, Ron, and I'm not going to get into this because I rarely do, because you know I'll go off. We have to make sure that the right people are in the places, the positions of power. And I know that you feel that too.
They did a study not too long ago, spent millions of dollars on a study to show that one of the best ways to improve your life and one of the best ways to do well on job interviews and in performance of different tasks is to go over them and go over them and go over them. And they called it to practice the way to be successful, to practice the way to do this and practice the way to do that. And I'm saying, you know, you spent millions of dollars to do that when all you had to do was ask a musician what the key to success is. You know, practice does not make perfect. It's correct practice that makes perfect. And so if you want to model yourself into a way of doing something positive, you've got to live that way. I read somewhere one time that anything you do for 90 days will become a habit, positive or negative. And if you take out time to try to make yourself into a positive individual, whether it's through music or through whatever else, you can make yourself into that individual by practicing what you preach and practicing what you do. And we are, unfortunately, in a time where people don't value doing things consistently, because we have this instant gratification. You flip a switch and you got this. You know,
that's right.
When these musical instruments came out, that you could hit a switch and you could play chords, you could get chords, and then you play a few notes and those notes would be recorded digitally, and you could play it all back, and you could hear what you had done, and all you did was 5 minutes worth of work. It gave the impression that music and endeavors like music are supposed to come easily. And anybody who's ever tried to be successful at anything knows that it is not something that comes easily. It is something that will come from work, and depending on the amount of work you invest in it, you will be good or you will not.
Yeah.
You know, it's up to you. The choice is clearly yours.
Yep, I remember when Carl Grubbs was on the show with me. Carl's cousin Naima was married to John Coltrane. So
right.
Carl, when he was a younger man, remembered very clearly, and this affected him powerfully, and it still does. He talks about it, and it's one of his fond memories. He would be in the company of John Coltrane all the time, but John would take his leave of him within a short period of time to practice in the back room.
Right, exactly. In the bathroom, a lot of great cases. You know, there are all kinds of stories of how Train used to carry his horn with him everywhere he went, and would excuse himself to somebody's bathroom and would play in the bathroom. And people, you know, kind of chuckle about that. But the acoustics, because of the ceramics in the bathroom,
yeah,
such that if you really want to get a feeling for what you sound like, you know, you go there, and I used to practice my flute in the bathroom because of that, because it really is an unreal sensation when you hear it. I don't know that I could spend as much time practicing in the bathroom as Train did, but but I could thoroughly understand why he did it, because once you hear the sound, it really is something.
So now, speaking of sounds, what made you decide? Because you've had a few CDs out there. You wanted to do this particular CD, brand new. When is it going to drop, Ron?
The word I got was that it's supposed to be delivered next week sometime, which means that the official drop, technically, from the record company will be the 1st of March, because it takes about 2 or 3 weeks for them to get everything out to all the vendors and things and all the venues that are going to carry it. And now, because of the digital outlets, it takes time to set up the digital sales like iTunes and other outlets like that. So technically, even though it'll be copies of it will be in my possession probably next week, by the end of next week. It won't really go out as an official drop until about the 1st of March.
Okay.
You know, and you know, you talk about me being the daddy of it. I mean, that is probably one of the hardest things to go through as a musician or an artist. You're waiting for the birth of that.
Right, right.
It doesn't seem like it's going to ever come.
Push,
and I have no idea how women go through it. Because it's tough enough as a man.
Oh, yeah, please. And nobody ever tells you how hard it is. This is quite an analogy. Just like with women and giving childbirth, no one ever tells artists when their CD is about to drop how hard that process is. Nobody ever explains the pain involved.
I'm telling you, really, as you're waiting, you know, because see, now you have, you know, I was able to give you an advance copy.
Right.
And,
thank you.
And so you had a chance to hear it. Well, you know, I'm still waiting, and I have some friends who have been waiting patiently and some impatiently for it to come out. And unfortunately, I have no control over it. And so that for me is the other part that's so frustrating, the fact that there's nothing I can do but sit and wait like everybody else is sitting and waiting.
Well, I'm so glad I got this, and I want to get to one of these tracks because I, of course, I love all of it, and I'll never get rid of the message that you sent to me about each track, because none of it is labeled. So each track you sent to me very painstakingly, the title of the song and who wrote the song, and you were very clear on what you wanted me to play. So can we play Blue Bossa and tell me about that?
Go right ahead. Yeah, well, Blue Bossa is one of those songs that pretty much summarizes what I was saying about what effect Latin jazz and Brazilian jazz specifically had on American music, because Blue Bossa was written by Kenny Dorham, and it's a blend of American blues and jazz with South American flavors. And as you hear it, you can hear a kind of marriage between bebop and Brazilian jazz. It's not quite bossa, but more of the Brazilian jazz kind of sound. And it's the kind of song that you can't help but tap your foot to and kind of bob your head as you're listening to, because it just has that feel.
Oh yeah.
So with that, I'll let you go ahead and spin it.
Okay, Quiet Nights is the name of the new CD by Ron Kearns, our guest, and here it is on Hyper Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
Professor is in the house, ladies and gentlemen. Ron Kearns right there, our guest from the brand new Quiet Nights CD with Paul Wingo on guitar, Kent Miller on bass, and Mark Prince on drums. Man, they are some choice folks surrounding you, and didn't that sound cool? Blue Bossa. Woo! Honey.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I learned a long time ago, and I love Miles Davis, but I love him for a lot of reasons why a lot of people might not. And one of the reasons why I love Miles was that Miles knew how to pick groups. If you go back
yes.
and look through the history and look at the people he had with him, there was a particular kind of chemistry that he was looking for. And at a certain point, you expect excellence in musicianship. You know, professional players are supposed to be able to play. So that goes without saying. If you choose a professional player to play with you, you should not expect them to be less than great.
Yeah.
But the one thing that sets groups apart in my mind as I listened to Miles' groups and as I chose groups over the years was the chemistry between the musicians. And the music has to come to life. You know, it has to be something that you listen to and you understand that this is a communication between players. You're being drawn into a conversation between good friends, and as one good friend hears something that he wants to play off of with the other, you know, it's oh yeah, you're right, Ron, and listen to this, you know, oh you're right, Mark, but check this out, this is what I was talking about, and so when you really go into it and understand that this is what's going on stage and on recordings, then you can really really appreciate what you're listening to, because it's not just okay, it's my turn to play, okay, take your turn to play, okay, I'll play my turn again. And as you listen, you'll hear little things like a rhythm that an outstanding drummer like Mark will play that that the bass player will react to, or the guitar
yes.
player will react to, or the sax player will react to. And as you hear that relationship between the different instruments as they communicate with each other through the song, you discover that it goes back to what we talked about before. The different flavors mix and blend to the point where you're no longer listening to a sax, a guitar, a bass, and a drum. You're listening to a group. The group becomes the organism that comes to the forefront. And as you listen, you hear the group expressing four people or four voices as one voice. And that's what I always get so excited about when I'm on stage or when I'm listening to someone else play. And that's what sets some groups apart in my mind from others.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can imagine, I mean, I'm not a musician. Some of us God chose to do other things. Thank you, Jesus. maybe it's not too late. I don't know. But I can't help but think, and certainly because of conversations through the years, there must be, to know that you have people around you that get you even a little must be a high, as compared to being in a position where you have to wonder if somebody's going to hit that note, or you have to do a body language thing on stage where you look at them and they know when to start. It seems like with the group that's assembled here, I just feel the flow. I mean, the flow is just such a groove all by itself. When you have that kind of unity of mind and that teamwork, you don't worry about anything.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things is, and people don't understand sometimes, in a studio, you have four different players in four different places.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody's isolated, somebody. And in some cases, we had a video camera on with monitors so we could see each other. But
wow.
we were all separated. But fortunately, because we all listened and we all shared the same vibe, as you listen, the impression hopefully that you get is that we're sitting on the bandstand in front of you, and we're playing and we're able to look at each other. We just heard and sensed when certain things were supposed to happen. And I learned that from my long-term bandmate. I had a band for 10 years with Kenny Reed, and Kenny Reed was nigh-sighted, and I used nigh-sighted instead of blind because there was no way you could ever describe Kenny as being blind. He was aware of everything at all times. And when Kenny and I played together, we did a recording live at Blues Alley, and excuse me, we had no visual cues, obviously, because Kenny couldn't see.
Right.
But as you listen to us play, our entrances and our cutoffs are as precise as if we had someone standing in front of us conducting, or that Kenny was able to look around and see everybody else. And so I learned in 10 years how to really, really listen and how to become one with the music from listening to a non-sighted person and playing with a non-sighted person for all that time. Because it was beyond anything you could see, obviously. And so you had to depend on the sense of hearing, and it was such a valuable lesson for me. And you know, Kenny was a very good friend anyway, so we had that going for ourselves. But it's just one of those things. And as a producer, when I choose groups to record, if it's not a set group that I'm recording, and the artist wants me to put together the rhythm section or an extra horn with more whatever, I'm also doing the same kind of thing as I would do putting my group together. I try to put together people who share the same kind of energy, who share the same kind of vibe, and who can work together, because I don't care how good musicians are. If I listen to a recording, I can very quickly tell whether this is a pickup group or whether it's a group that has had some kind of time together, work together in some kind of way.
Interesting.
Because it's just a very natural flow that you will hear. Not enough that the recording is not a good recording or an outstanding recording. As someone said years ago, the difference between Blue Note recordings and prestige recordings was that. You know, it came down to rehearsals and chemistry. and the Blue Note recordings generally had the chemistry and had the people who worked together, and the Prestige recordings had outstanding musicians playing, and so they were able to make up for the lack of familiarity by the fact that they were very, very familiar with one another.
Gotcha. I never heard anybody explain it that way, because I played Grant Green a little while ago, and man, it just, you know, when you think about somebody having their life end when there's been so much of an impact on people, and actually there's many who view him as underrated, and now the more I get immersed in his work, the more I agree. But between 1961 and 1965 on Blue Note, he was the most utilized person on that label because he was always in demand for sessions, and then he had his own work. And, man, he just made things sparkle when he was on them.
Yeah. I did a recording at a studio called Systems 2 in New York, and the guy who was engineering that recording had worked with Grant, and we were talking about it because Grant's son was a friend of his, and you know, he really hipped me to Grant. And one of the reasons that Grant was popular with Blue Note was that there are players that you choose that are immediately recognizable in sound, but also
right.
are able to come into any situation and work well, and they can be a first take player. So you don't have to worry about going back and trying to fix something when they're there. You know that they're going to nail it first time through if necessary. And when you get that kind of name in New York or anywhere else, you're going to be the first call. You know, you get the right of first refusal to some of the best recordings that are going to be out there, because every producer knows that if he or she calls you, you're going to nail it, and they're going to get the most efficient use of time for the recording as possible. And the bottom line is, from a producer's side especially, time in the studio is money. I mean, that's no place.
Oh, yeah.
There's no place to rehearse. There's no place to get to know everybody. You either come in, as they say, you come in correct or you don't. And the bottom line is, when you're the person, which is what the producer's thing is, when you're the person has to account to both the musicians and to the money people, you know, you want to make sure that you can strike a happy medium between both parties, because you don't want the musicians to feel like you're rushing them because time is money, and you don't want the executive producers to feel that you're squandering their money and you're not getting an efficient use of time.
That's right. So
once again, it goes back to the same thing we talked about earlier. It's all about the chemistry, because if you don't have the chemistry, and if you don't have the egos that don't mind yielding to one another when it's time to yield, then you're going to be in for a long day, and you're going to be in for a not-so-good recording session.
Oh, and here you are. You're trying to breathe life into music, and it's supposed to be fun, and you've got to worry about temperament or the chemistry not being right or somebody not getting an arrangement. Oh, that must be so frustrating.
It can be. Fortunately, not for me, because when I choose the musicians that are going to be on the recordings that I produce, the chemistry is going to be there and all those things are going to be there. Because my opinion is, I'm creating, as a producer, I'm creating a historical document.
Yep.
And it's going to outlive me. And hopefully it's going to say something about the time I lived in and how we thought about things. Because now, you know, I never met John Coltrane, but I feel like I know him very well.
Yeah.
Because someone took the time to make sure that the way he was recorded and the work that he did was representative of the kind of person he was. And so as I listen to his music, I can hear his spiritual side, and I know basically what kind of person he was. And as I said, I kind of feel like I knew him, even though obviously we never met.
Mm. That's what people are going to be saying about you, and I can't help but think that this is going to be one of those recordings that's going to do a lot better, Ron, than even you thought that it was going to be. I love what you've done with Quiet Nights. You've put some real different kinds of music on here, some pivotal love songs, and we're going to get to one of them in a minute. But why is it that you wanted to record this particular album and call it Quiet Nights? I mean, obviously, there's a little bit of a nod to Jobim, but tell me why.
Well, when I was about 15 years old, my brother, who was into jazz, brought home a recording with Stan Getz and Charlie Byrd on it called Jazz Samba.
Mm-hmm.
And Jazz Samba featured the music of Antonio Carlos Jobim, Tom Jobim. And the sound of Stan Getz spoke to me because I just loved that silkiness in his sound and the seamlessness in his lines, and I could hear what was going on. And the chemistry on that recording was just so good, and a gentleman I was fortunate enough to get to know fairly well and who was mentor to a lot of my friends and I had a chance to work with, Keita Betts, was the bass player on that recording. And it just, as I said, it just spoke to me, and I never recorded any of those songs from it, never really did too much, but it all affected me in the way I listened to other music. And so that Brazilian feel just really, really stepped out and kind of grabbed me by the collar and said, look, listen to me. so when I had a chance to do a performance of Brazilian songs, I decided to grab some songs. And I had a very good friend who was my longtime collaborator and co-producer by the name of Ronnie Wells, who was an outstanding mentor to vocalists as well as being an outstanding vocalist and recording artist. Excuse me. And Ronnie turned me on to two of the songs that are on that recording, Quiet Nights and The Night Has a Thousand Eyes.
Mm.
And those songs and a few other songs really jumped out at me. And the first of about 20 recordings that I produced for Ronnie had The Night Has a Thousand Eyes on it. And I did that as a kind of tip of the hat to her with those songs. And she really loved Brazilian music, and she was one of those people who would actually learn the verses of songs as well as learn. And so this was the first recording that I did after her death, and I decided that I needed to do some of the things that we did together that we never really recorded together.
That was
part of it. So this recording represents pretty much every step of my life in jazz and in popular music. From when I was 15 until now, and it's just a collection of all the things that I've learned and all the things that I've appreciated. And everybody who knows me knows I love ballads, and I love listening to ballads, I love playing ballads. And one of the ballads on there was suggested to me on Saturday before we went into the studio.
Get out of here.
And yeah, a good friend of mine suggested, you know, that I might want to record When I Fall in Love, because I just kind of casually said, you know, I'm looking for a ballad. And so she said, well, you know, she sent me a copy of Nat King Cole doing that particular ballad on YouTube. And so you know, I said, yeah, I ought to do that. And so I called Paul and told him, and neither of us had ever done the song before. And so I told him that Saturday, and that Monday, we were in the studio, and we took two takes and put it down.
wow, because you would never know that. I mean, it's like you have been doing that for at least 20 years. Wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow, and then for folks to get a taste, because already on Facebook, my friend Rick wants to know how he can get a hold of this CD, and I said, put a bookmark in that thought. I'm going to talk to Ron. Just so you know, if you're going to get this CD, Girl from Ipanema is on here, as is Quiet Nights that Ron mentioned, and One Note Samba. and one of my all-time favorite love songs of all time, My One and Only Love, that we're about to hear. Is that okay with you?
Please, please.
Let me tell you something. It's a shame that you can't get a hold of this before Valentine's Day, because if you could, you could get really lucky.
Exactly.
This is Ron Kearns. Go ahead. What?
No, I was just gonna say I always do a disclaimer when I do ballots. I always warn people: look, don't listen to this around somebody that you might get in trouble with, because it's gonna touch you. It's gonna touch you, and it might make you touch them. So be very careful when and how you listen to these ballots that I play, because I try to put everything I can possibly put into them.
Well, it's just a darn good thing that my son is not here, because I'm by myself, and that's a good thing. Ron Kearns here on saxophone, and his friends, My One and Only Love, from Quiet Nights on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Thank you.
Suddenly the room got smaller. Oh, my gosh. Woo! Ron Kearns and friends from Quiet Nights, My One and Only Love. Now, not a lot of people have the right to do that song, Ron, because that's a heavy-duty lyric. If folks know that lyric and then to hear the instrumentation of that tune, you got to really love that song to do it justice, and you did.
Right.
That is beautiful.
Well, that song was the first CD that I produced. Interestingly enough, I think Norman asked you to play Nookie's Blues, and Nookie's Blues was written for a friend of mine who I was producing by the name of Paul Carr, and Paul had never played ballads or didn't play ballads, and I said, now Paul, I said, you know, your sound is a sound that I can hear you playing a ballad that I did an arrangement on years ago called My One and Only Love. And I said, I want you to play it. Paul spent a whole weekend just totally immersed in that song and recorded it. And, of course, when the CD came out, everybody just felt like he had been playing it for the last 20 years of his life.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it's one of those songs that's kind of infectious because, you know, you've heard me say many times that I'm just a sucker for melodies.
Yeah,
and there are some songs that the melodies are just so well written that you can't help but do them justice if you really really try. But I want to point out something. You know, even though the vendors won't have the CD until March, if there's anybody who wants to get the CD before then,
go ahead.
They'll be able to get it directly from me, and they can email me at ron@ronkearns.com, and it's KEARNS, and just let me know, you know, they want to order one, and I'll be able to tell them through email how to get it. And anybody who's a Facebook user can contact me, inbox me at Ron Kearns on Facebook or Ron Kearns Music on Facebook. And and I can give them the same information, or they can contact you, Trish, and you can
sure.
You can pass it on. Before it hits the streets, I will have some advanced copies, and I will be able to make them available to anybody who is interested. And hopefully, if they get here before Valentine's Day, somebody might be able to take My One and Only Love home and get it. So I don't know. Once again, it's one of those things. I have absolutely no idea. They may be delivered, you know, today. They may be delivered next week. I have absolutely no idea, which is so frustrating to me.
Aww.
Back and wait.
Well, you know, you have to think of it this way. It's happening for a reason, and maybe it's to get the attention of a group of folks or a person. You never know. But look,
right.
As long as folks can get the CD from you, that's great. And Norman, by the way, is still hanging on to your every word in the chat room.
Okay. I have to look down here and get this chat room, because you mentioned the chat room a couple of times.
Yes, the chat room is a glorious thing. And actually, Norman wanted to let you know, you had mentioned Roanoke, Virginia, and he knows Teddy Wilson, one of the Tuskegee Airmen who's
from
Roanoke.
Oh, yeah. Well, Teddy Wilson and Ralph Clater were the two that I knew. Ralph Clater had two brothers that were doctors. One was a doctor, one was a dentist, and he had a gas station that was located directly behind their clinic. And so Roanoke. Well, you know, Roanoke is interesting because Roanoke produced Renee Marie, Don Pullen, Cedric Lawson, who played with and worked with Miles Davis,
mm-hmm.
and a few Byron Morris and a few other people who went into jazz. But at the time, we were all being trained basically as classical musicians and music we got from the church because Roanoke was not necessarily a big "quote unquote jazz town,"
right?
But because it had a, and this isn't a Black History fact about Roanoke, because it had a hotel, the Dumas Hotel, where Ellington's band and Basie's band could actually come and stay. One of the few places that these bands on the chicken dumpling circuit could come and actually stay in a hotel and not have to stay in people's homes.
That's right.
They could come and stay there. And so the location of the hotel was on a street called Henry Street, but we commonly called it the Yard. And so if you were one of those people who had access to the Yard, you could go and you could hear these guys playing when they were in Roanoke. You could see them at the different things. But it was just very interesting how the history of the music and how the history of certain cities kind of gets entwined, because Don Pullen was one of those guys that caught fire because of his ability to hear different things and to do different things. And a lot of people that weren't really hip to Don need to get hip to him, because he was an outstanding musician.
Mm. It's so nice to hear you talk about, because you know so much. I mean, not only because you have been an artist for quite a while, but because of your teaching status, you know, you're privy to more facts, and you've dug so deep through the years. So when you talk about somebody being a good musician, they are really good. Oh, and talking about, there's a hotel in Ocean City, Maryland, that's very much like the hotel that you just mentioned. And the name escapes me right now, but I have it in my Facebook pictures. One of those beautiful hotels that has been black owned and operated for a number of years. And this was where Cab Calloway and Duke Ellington used to stay, because they were not able to stay in the usual establishments.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. I just love to hear, I don't love to hear the history and to know that people endured it, but I just love to soak up that information. And do you believe it's like 53 minutes past the hour?
Well, no. Well, you know, the old adage, you know, time passes when you're having fun.
That's right. Well, I know we played Nookie's Blues, and in actuality we played three songs, but you know that I was craving to play the last track that you have on Quiet Nights, and I love this to my core. Explain to us about If I Can Help Somebody. I know it's a traditional song, Ron.
Well, it's been my own personal mantra. You know, if I can help somebody, then my living will not be in vain. And as a teacher and as a person, I've always felt that it's my responsibility to I said earlier, each one teach one.
Yeah.
The other part of that is each one reach one. And that was a thing that was said, you know, no man stands any taller than he does when he stoops to help a child.
Mm, yes.
And that is one of those that is one of those things. You know, it's I just feel my responsibility as a person, and that goes into, as I told you, about my feeling about being a producer. This music was created originally by African Americans, but we don't possess it solely. But it is important that as an African American musician, I carry the torch and keep things going, so that people will be able to realize the contributions that people like me made. And so if I can help somebody to understand the significance of what we did and how we did what we did, then it's very important that I do that. And so it also addresses my spiritual side. And as I told you, I was the son of a minister, and so there are just a lot of things that got passed on to me just from watching my dad and how he interacted with people and the kind of care he had for his congregants. And I used to always make a difference between preachers and pastors.
Mm-hmm.
Preachers look at themselves as people who deliver the word and preach, but pastors look at themselves as people who actually shepherd the flock and do things for people and try to make sure that they do things to better people's lives hands-on, not just this is what I say, but this
right.
is what I said, and this is what I do, and this is how I do it. And so, you know, taking from him the whole idea of being responsible to help somebody and having responsibility. And you talked about that earlier. And irrespective of what political party you are affiliated with, one of the things that should always be in your mind that it is not a bad thing to help somebody. It is not a bad thing to reach out and lend a helping hand. It does not lower you to do that. It does not lower the person that you're reaching out to. You're simply helping somebody and you're doing something. And I don't see anything negative about wanting to help somebody. And so the only thing that bothers me sometimes as I listen to things on the political front now is that helping people has become a negative thing or something bad. And people who want to aspire to be politically involved have to help people behind the scenes because they can't allow people to know that they're helping people because reaching out to someone has become a bad thing. And so my own personal statement of if I can help somebody hopefully lets people know where I'm coming from and the kind of person I hope to be.
Well, I know what kind of a person you are, and I'm really glad that you spent the time. God bless you. I know this is going to really infiltrate people's souls when they hear it. And I'll be talking to you, and we'll be talking more about the success of Quiet Nights because it's going to happen, Ron.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for being there. God, I love you, and I'm going to talk to you soon.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, Ron.
Take care. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Ron Kearns, and we're going to leave you with that, if I can help somebody from Quiet Nights. Thanks so much for being there today. We'll see you with Scott Allman on February 14th, Valentine's Day, with some real love songs. You'll see. You'll love this. Check it out.